the means of grace, and God has given us his word, prayer, sacrament, and discipline. One of the things that is so important to recognize regarding addiction is what was already mentioned earlier today, the significant shame, guilt, and judgment that people place on themselves and are received from other people for this particular problem of addiction. And there's a singer-songwriter that, where did Cindy already left? Yeah, she only wanted to hear the first bit, I guess. We'll see. Cindy and I had seen this really fun guy play, if you ever get a chance, the David Mayfield Parade. And if you ever see that around, you have to go see him. It's so much fun. But he had this line in there, "It's hard to break a broken man. You can't break me like I can." And I thought, dang, boy, that really hits it right there, doesn't it? And we are, right, we are the ones who give ourselves the most shame and the most guilt and the most brokenness. And so this is a really heavy burden that a lot of people who have addiction are dealing with. And not only the shame of the fact that they have used or continue to use, right, but then all of the debris and all of the problems that they've put themselves in the past, and the shame that's associated with that, some of which we can never even imagine. And so it's important to recognize that. And one of the ways that we in the church have to deal with shame, guilt, is confession. And the freedom that comes, that God that has given us this grace and this blessing to be able to confess our sins to one another. And this is something that I think we probably neglect in our Reformed tradition and current life, the way we can build this up more than we currently do. But one of the things that I think that I look upon the 12 step, like AA, with envy, is that they do so many things well, in my opinion, NA. And one of that is they're vulnerable with one another. I mean, in some ways, how many people have actually attended a 12-step meeting before, AA or NA or something like that before? Is, you know, sometimes these meetings put our church meetings to shame. And these are people who are actually able to be truly vulnerable with one another. And they say it like they've removed all masks, right? We in the church, right, we like to put our masks on and pretend that everything is together and that we're not messy and that we're able to handle things. But when you go into these meetings, it's just part of the culture, and they work through these steps to get you there. But they take the masks off, and that's okay, because we're all in it together. And, you know, if we can be like that with one another and just know that we're sinful too, and your sin isn't really greater than my sin necessarily, but we all have some degrees of sin, we're all messy, we're all dirty, we're all imperfect, then maybe we can start confessing these things to one another, knowing that you're not going to get that judgment from me. But also, it's so important when we do that to know the freedom we can point our brother and sister to Christ and say, "You are forgiven, because Christ died for you, and he's given you life. And this is what the scripture says, so this is yours." And it's also so important to remember, in my opinion, that, you know, God, even when he disciplines us, he is disciplining us as a loving father. And even when we get in trouble with our sin, he is looking at us, and he is glancing at us, and his eye is upon us, not as a vengeful judge, but as a loving father. And that's because he's looking upon Christ, and we are hidden in Christ, and that we may be disciplined, but we're not disciplined in his wrath. All that wrath was poured out upon Christ, and so we have that freedom now. Whoever conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will obtain mercy. So, and this is the book that I highly recommend everybody read, Embodied Hope by Kelly Capick. What happens in confession? You have a reckoning with the real world. Okay, again, people are messy, and I sinned. Okay, and in AA, they talk about, there's so many great phrases in AA, but rocks are hard and water's wet. Okay? And sometimes that's what I tell my kids. And you know what? It's just the way it is. Rocks are hard and water's wet, and you have to come to grips with this. Sets our lives back into the comfort of God. It requires honesty, not just sympathy, right? So it requires honesty. Oh, it wasn't anything, you know, don't worry about it. That wasn't such a big deal. That doesn't help the person. No, yeah, that was sinful. You know, that was bad for you, and that was bad for your brother by the decision you made, and that was wrong. Okay. So it requires our sympathy, but we have to be honest about that. We don't want to minimize sin. Okay, so that's what the world does now, and that's sort of what a lot of the therapeutics do now too, where I get it, and I want us to be empathetic, right? But also what the church has that the world doesn't have is again, a reckoning with the reality that, yeah, this is sin. Yeah.
I think our self-righteousness gets in the way, and then I would never do that. We have no compassion on people, except to the grace of God, there go I. I mean, we really are and do, and that's, we don't see them as people.
Yes. Yeah, yes.
Human beings made in God's image, and then
that's exactly right. And I think you nailed it in the sense that we don't see ourselves like that. Where if we don't see ourselves like that, there's something wrong with our seeing. Because that's who we are, right? And if our brother is coming before us to confess, they need to do that knowing that they're going to be received by somebody who is on the same plane as them, as sinners. Okay, because I know, right? I mean, this is something that again, remember, when it struck me when I was dealing with these patients early on, is when they were telling me these stories, I could see that in my life, and I could see that in the decisions that I made, and I could see that where I would fall and fail. And it might not have been to the degree that they did, but it really struck me. And so if we can get to that point where we can stop pretending that they are something other and that we're not, but we're all equally culpable and equally sinful, then that can make a world of difference. But totally agree. Because it dehumanizes the other, right? Requires honesty, not just sympathy. So private confession is great, right? But private confession is we can also let ourselves off too easy. We can rationalize things, and we also don't get the benefit of hearing from someone else. This is what Scripture says about you. Okay? Or hearing from our pastor, right, that we are forgiven. And we break the cycle of self-deception and isolation. So this is something that brings people back together. Church discipline, I won't go into that. I'm sure you all know about what the purpose of church discipline is and what it brings. Bonhoeffer. And life together, sin. The greatest psychological insight, ability, and experience cannot comprehend this one thing, what sin is. Secular psychological wisdom knows what need and weaknesses and failures are, but it does not know the ungodliness of the human being. In the presence of a psychologist, I am only sick. In the presence of another Christian, I can be a sinner. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And then Kelly Capick. While I greatly value the work of psychologists, Bonhoeffer's concern deserves our attention. Far too often, the contemporary church has reduced pastoral care of people to a referral to the local psychologist or counselor. Again, don't hear me saying this isn't necessary, because it may be necessary, okay? But it's not sufficient, okay? That's the point I'm trying to make. We need not therapy only, we need forgiveness. We need grace, and this comes to us most clearly not from those with advanced degrees, but by sinners who take refuge in the shelter of the cross. So from a professional therapeutic standpoint, people are sick, there is an innate goodness to people, and the answer is you find the answer in yourself. Follow your heart. Where from a biblical standpoint is, or the pastoral standpoint, people are sick, yep. However, people are also infected and infused with sin, and people are messy, and so it creates a lot of problems. And then the ultimate answer is in God, not in ourselves, and so that's what we're able to draw from. Noverum te, noverum me, if anybody knows Latin, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but this is to know I would know you, God. I would know myself. So to truly understand ourselves is we need to first understand and know who God is, which the world does not come from, right? So that's what we as the church, that's our obligation, is to help people understand themselves in the light of God. I won't read Augustine's quote. Memento mori is remember death or consider death or know that you will die. Remember that you will die. So I always thought that this would be a great tattoo sometime. If I ever got the only tattoo I ever thought about getting was, what the heck was I thinking? Because I know that, like, if I got a tattoo when I was in high school, I'd be looking at the, you know, Duran right now or something like that. I'm like, what the hell was I, heck was I thinking? But the other one is memento mori, right? Because I do think there, and this is what they used to put on, you know, back in the olden days, they used to, you'd see this in these old graves. I don't know, do they have these in the graveyards out here? It's probably older than Civil War, grave awards, but certainly out in Europe and everything. But the whole idea was when you go to a graveyard or even in churches where they'd have graves and stuff, you remember, it is good for you to remember that you are mortal and that you will die. And that fact should color your life now, what you are hoping in now, how you are living now, the decisions you are making now, that way you are spending your time. So maybe I'll get that tattoo someday.
Where would you put it?
Well, that's a private question. We'll ask Cindy where she would want. Teach me your paths. All right, so yeah, so to end with that, okay, again, the Psalms. To me, I love the Bible, all the scripture, but the Psalms have been my lifeblood. And when I've gone through my own struggles with, you know, various things, it's if I just need to, I need the Psalms. And there's so much in the Psalms. But teach me your paths. And Psalm 25 is so beautiful. All right, addictions. So let's go ahead and we're going to talk about what addiction is. This is a great book, came out maybe 2 years ago. If anybody wants a good comprehensive understanding of the history of addiction and models and treatments, I highly recommend this. This is by Carl Fisher, who himself is an addiction psychiatrist like me, but he also is somebody who suffered from substance use disorder. And it's called The Urge, or History of Addiction. Questions about addictions are questions about what it means to be human. And then I think, yeah, that's right, okay, because we all have a degree of addiction in us. What are the models? There's the moral model, the medical disease model, the biopsychosocial model, and then talk about spirituality. So addiction, this word, addiction, first comes up in 1953. John Frith, who was a Christian martyr, was the first to use the word addict in English. And ad dicere, or speak to, or say to, it was a legal term. I have given myself over to something. So it was even sort of a positive, it had a positive connotation, and it had a legal a force to it, where you would go to the council or whatever it was, right? And I said, I'm giving myself over to this person, for instance, okay? I am ad speaking to. It became a Protestant word referencing that gray area between free will and compulsion. It was a choice to give up choice. Again, I'm giving myself over to maybe as an indentured servant to somebody. Okay, so I'm giving up my choice. It was an action rather than a condition or a status. And then in 1609, you see the first time that Puritans began referring to this, to addiction as a condition or a state of being, as opposed to an action. 1774, Anthony Benezé, an American educator and abolitionist, described alcoholics as bound in slavery and noted their tendency to self-accelerate and used addiction terms to describe this. So very early on in 1774. How many people are familiar with what the DSM is? All right, so the Diagnostic Statistician's Manual is basically, this is the text that is used by behavioral health providers in the medical field psychology as the ultimate authority in defining what are diagnoses and conditions. Okay? And so what is in a word? We hear various terms, addiction, misuse, abuse, dependence, and substance use disorder. But from a clinical standpoint, addiction is not a word that's used in the DSM to describe a diagnosis. Okay, but addiction is more of a word that's used colloquially within our culture to describe a whole bunch of other things. Like people will say, I'm addicted to shopping, right? That's not in the DSM. Okay? Really, the terms now is substance use disorder. And the way that the best way that I sort of teach about the DSM, it's a field guide, like a bird field guide. All right? Is, you look outside today, and you'll probably see a medium-sized bird that is brown, mostly brown. It's got a shorter beak that's a yellow beak, and it's got a red breast. What is it? Okay, so I just delineated to you a number of criteria that then you were able to say, oh, that's a robin. All this does, the DSM, is delineates a number of criteria for each condition so that one clinician can say to another, oh, that's major depression disorder, or oh, that's a substance use disorder, which is what we'll get into. So it's a field, it's nothing more and it's nothing less. It's gone through a number of iterations. The most recent actually is DSM-5 TR. So the whole category is what's called substance-related and addictive disorders. The first criteria that needs to be in existence is a maladaptive pattern of substance use leading to clinically significant impairment or distress, as manifested by at least two of the following criteria occurring within a 12-month period. So, if you are using substances and that is not a pattern of use that is leading to clinically significant impairment or distress, you don't have a substance use disorder or you don't have addiction as defined by this DSM. With me? Okay. And that's the necessary condition. And then, do you have two or more of the other ones? First, Shane, and then I'll go back.
What's clinically significant?
Boy, that's a great question, right? And so that is subjective, but it's going to be based ultimately on the clinician who's seeing you, right? But there should be a larger context of understanding based on that clinician's training and what is current evidence and practice this sort of thing. Yeah, but there's a degree of subjectivity to that. What does that mean?
Well, I was thinking, am I okay? And then you go to the book and you look up the definition, but the answer could still be no, you're not.
Yep, that's right.
Maladaptive, mal is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's maladaptive?
Yeah, maladaptive means that it's created bad patterns for you. Okay, you've adapted poorly to life circumstances because of this. Does that help? All right, so these are the criteria. You can't see this, but I'll go there real quick. If you are using the substance in larger amounts or for longer periods of time than intended, unsuccessful efforts to cut down or quit using, so you're making deals and promises, you know what, I woke up with a hangover today over the toilet, never, dear God, I'm never going to do this again. Well, tomorrow, boy, there's a game on, and I'm getting kind of thirsty, and here I go again, right? Multiple efforts to cut down. Excessive time spent using the drug, okay, or trying to find the drug or recovering from the substance. Intensive desires or urges for the drug, we'll talk about those later, or what we call the cravings. Failure to fulfill major obligations. So this person, because of their use, whether it's using because of their intoxication or because they're recovering or they're going out looking for stuff, that they're not able to be the parent, the husband, the employee that they need to be. They're failing, not going to school. continue to use despite it causing social problems or interpersonal problems? Is it wrecking your marriage, but you continue to use despite the fact that it's causing problems in your marriage? Are important activities and hobbies cut down because you continue to use? Recurrent use in physically hazardous situations, drunk driving, for instance, or operating heavy machinery. Recurrent use despite physical or psychological problems caused by or worsening, you know, use. It's amazing how many patients I see because they've used the needle and contracted these horrible infections or heart conditions where they've gone ahead heart surgery to get their hearts replaced because of the infections. Still, once they get those, go out and use, right? So that would be a hardcore example. Tolerance. Tolerance means that you've used the substance long enough that you've trained your brain to tolerate that amount of substance on a regular basis. Okay, so if somebody had never had a drink of alcohol before and they were to crack open a can of beer, you probably drink Yingling here, I bet, right? So you crack open a can of Yingling and you never had one before and you down it, you're gonna get a buzz, no doubt about it. However, if you start practicing drinking on a regular basis and basically you get yourself up to a six pack, you're not gonna get a buzz if you've been drinking a six pack daily for, you know, 3 or 6 months. You've developed a tolerance to that. And so your body needs more and more to be able to get the same effect. And then withdrawal. Have you been using long enough that your body is essentially dependent upon physiologically or even psychologically on the substance? If you were to stop it, then you're gonna go through a predictable withdrawal pattern from that. And each class of substance has their predictable withdrawal from it. 10 classes of substances. So I'm curious to hear what substances you can think of or class of substances that are out there that could be categorized. You've named some of them already today when we were talking about substances. So you've already named alcohol. You've named tobacco or nicotine. What else?
Caffeine,
yep. Opioids. What are opioids? So opioids are painkillers. What else? Anybody else know what opioid?
Just opiate-based.
Yeah, that's right. And if we get to our opioid section, I'll talk about it.
What's heroin?
Heroin is an opioid. Yep. Pain pills, heroin, fentanyl.
Antidepressants?
Antidepressants. Nope, those would not be opioids. Yep.
Oh, I've been...
Oh, another class. But there's some anti-anxiety medicines that would be one of the class, and what those are called sedative hypnotics. And these are the main class of those are benzodiazepines. So if you've heard of medicines before, like Xanax or Klonopin or Ativan, that would be in that class. Okay, so that's another class. What else?
Psychedelics.
Yeah. So inhalants is one, and then psychedelics is another. Stimulants. So stimulants, the class of stimulants are methamphetamines and cocaine. I'm surprised no one said this already.
Marijuana.
Cannabis is the technical term for that, but marijuana. Yep.
Like ADHD.
So that would be stimulants. That would be in the same class of methamphetamine. Yep, but you're absolutely right. Did we get them all?
Barbiturates,
yep. You guys are doing pretty good. You guys are doing pretty good. But, we'll talk about that in a minute. But that would not be a class of substances. So alcohol, caffeine, cannabis, hallucinogens. Somebody said psychedelics. Inhalants. Okay, it would be another one. So I think you said inhalants too, right? Inhalants could be anything from sniffing glue and markers to, this is going to shock some of you, but huffing paint. Opioids. Sedative hypnotics or anxiolytics, stimulants, tobacco, and then the final class of other. We don't know what it is, but let's do it. All right, and then also on top of that in the DSM, those are the substances that I just talked about, but also in DSM, they've got gambling disorder. Currently, the only official diagnosis of addiction in the DSM is gambling disorder. Okay, it's a persistent and recurrent problematic gambling behavior leading to four or more of those criteria. And then there's a chapter in the end of the book that are conditions for further study, meaning that these are possible addictions out there, but we need to research it and study it further, one of which is internet gaming that's listed. All right. Now, that begs the question, because we all know either through our own lives or the lives of friends and family and neighbors, is people are addicted to pornography or sex, right? Food, maybe even exercise, okay? Maybe shopping, right? But so we always use these sort of terms too. And some of these, even though they're not in the DSM, certainly look like they would meet the same criteria that you see for substances in the book, okay? But if you go to your local hospital, right, who's there to serve you and your needs, and you say, I have a food addiction, good luck getting that paid for by your insurance. Okay, so now let's talk about the models that have been in existence. The one that's probably been the longest model of how do I look about addiction? What do I think about addiction? How do I conceptualize it? The first one is the moral model. And this is where a person has complete free will. This is the Pelagian model. Okay, they've got free will, and that free will is unimpaired. You have a choice to make, you're making bad choices. Okay, the person chooses to drink and has complete control over that decision. Stop drinking. You keep drinking, stop it. Misuse of the substance is a willful expression of an immoral character. You're a bad person, you keep drinking. And a sin of self-indulgence. Stop thinking about yourself and start thinking about other people. And self-destruction. Can't you see how disastrous this is for you? And that it's a self-inflicted disorder. So it emphasizes personal responsibility, okay? And this has been this has been the dominant and still remains the dominant idea and frame by which many people see this problem. America's first addiction epidemic was rum. Okay, alcohol was brought into the United States by European settlers. Just to get you an idea, in 1770, I noticed that in the, what was it, Doblin's pub or the restaurant that we were in last night, right? They had a couple of drinks that were rum-based drinks, right? And I thought, oh yeah, that's right, because rum would have been the popular, you know, thing, you know, back at that time. So rum consumption in 1770, the 1.7 million American colonists consumed 7.5 million gallons of rum a year.
5 gallons each.
Yep, equally nearly. Well, you know your math. What do you do? Doggone. Equals nearly 4.5 gallons for each man, woman, and child in the 13 colonies. All right, so there's your rum epidemic. There's Doblin's pub right there. There's a guy falling down. All right, so Dr. Benjamin Rush. Who knows who Benjamin Rush was? So some good students of American history, right? He was a founding father, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and he was the quintessential American physician. The old logo for the American Psychiatric Association had his face as his head as the logo. So he is considered the quintessential American physician, American really psychiatrist. And he was founding father, actually treated a lot of the other founding fathers, and was way ahead of his time in how he thought about a lot of things. And really novel guy. And this is something he said about addiction, you know, way back then. My observations authorized me to say that persons who have been addicted to them, this is basically spirits, alcohol, should abstain from them suddenly and entirely. Taste not, handle not, touch not should be inscribed upon every vessel that contains spirits in the house of a man who wishes to be cured of habits of intemperance. Habitual drunkenness should be regarded not as a bad habit, but as a disease. Benjamin Rush, way back then, before he had any of the evidence that we have today with brain imaging, receptors, neurons, etc., processes, okay, he said way back then that this is a disease. And the cure is to keep them away from the substance. And that was the cure time, right? So a phenomenal brain this guy had. That doesn't show up very well up here. But anyway, drunkenness resembles certain hereditary, family, and contagious diseases. So he was able to recognize that back then. Powerful. Nearly all diseases have their predisposing causes, including intemperate use of distilled spirits. He identified alcohol as the causal agent for this disease. If nobody was exposed to alcohol, nobody would get the disease of alcoholism, as they described it back then, or later on. Loss of control was the primary symptom. They could not stop. They lost that ability to stop. Abstinence is the only cure, and so his solution was to start developing creations of sober homes for the care of the confirmed drunkard. Okay, this is terminology they used back then, confirmed drunkard. Not to worry, however, important disclaimer. His remarks concerned only strong liquors. Wine and beer, in his view, were salutary thirst quenchers. So, you can rest easy. 1819, Konstantin von Bruhl-Kramer, who's a German physician, first coined a term, dipsomania. And that's a lovely term, dipsomania, to describe uncontrollable craving for alcohol. Dipso means drink, right? And mania means crazy. 1825, Lyman Beecher, co-founder of the American Temperance Society. Intemperance was an addiction to sin. Aren't we all addicted to sin? An evil habit, a, quote, disease as well as a crime. 1849, Dr. Magnus Huss, a Swedish public health physician, was the first to coin the term alcoholism that then started taking traction among the healthcare system. The temperance movement, okay, 1820 to 1920, okay, this is like the hardcore moral movement of addiction. Lips that touch liquor shall not touch ours. Thank God. Okay. So here you have like a track of the time. Yeah, I'll read it to you because you can't really see it, I bet. But the home of an indulgent mother. And you know what? If somebody developed alcoholism, moms, it's your fault. Okay, because this is what happens. This is a drunkard's grave, okay? It's, you know what it starts with? Piecing between meals. That means snacking. Mom, you let your kids start snacking between meals, you're one step towards drunkenness. Okay? Patent medicines and soothing syrups. Plenty of pickles and pork. Mexicanized dishes and pepperences. Candies and rich pastries, tea, coffee, and cocoa, sodas, pop, and ginger ale, tobacco and cigarettes, cards, dice, and pool after tobacco and cigarettes. And then, of course, naturally, it leads to liquor and strong drink, and then the drunkard's grave. Okay, so these are kind of the ideas that have been out there. And this is just another picture. You have this woman crying with her little boy, and you could see the steps that this guy took ultimately just from a few drinks, you know, the steps that then led to his blowing himself, looks like with a gun. The drunkard's home, then there's just another example of the drunkard's home. I won't go ahead and read that. Did you have a question?
So we're laughing at that, but how much of the idea of a gateway drug or gateway thing of people starting small and then progressing to...
Yeah.
There's something empirical in that, but not absolute.
And probably not Mexicanized meals, right? But there are definitely gateway drugs, which means there are three of these, that if you were to use these as somebody before the age of 18, if you are to use any of these three substances, or these are the most three common substances that certainly predict you will continue to use those substances into adulthood and develop addictions to other substances, very clear that this is the case. Do you know what those three are?
Marijuana.
That's one. Two?
Yeah.
Three. You got it. All right. So without a doubt is that, you know, again, right? Don't get me on the marijuana talk, because I could talk for that for probably a week. But one of the things that the marijuana industry is trying to convince people today is that it's the answer to our opioid epidemic. And that if you just use marijuana, you're not going to be using heroin. We all know, for those who are in the addiction field, that's absolute nonsense. And as an example, when I was running my inpatient unit, I would do these groups, and I'd have medical students with me and residents with me. And I'd go to each patient, we'd be in a circle. What substance did you start with when you were young? Marijuana. What was the first substance? And these are people who I'm treating now for heroin addiction. What substance did you use? Marijuana. What substance did you use? Marijuana. How old were you? 14, 13, 12, whatever it was. And then every single one of them. And then I'd laugh at the end. I'd say, well, good thing marijuana is not a gateway drug, isn't it? And then everyone would laugh, including the patients, and the medical students would be like, inebriate homes again, right? So the idea was to get these people out of the community, put them in a place where they don't have access to substances and then the alcohol, and then they will get better. You want to see this. So Carrie Nation was a person who was arrested 30 times between 1990 and 1910 for hatchetations. And what she would do is she would go into these bars with a hatchet and start breaking up the bar with a hatchet to stop people from drinking. So again, right? If you get rid of the bars, then you will get rid of alcoholism. So all of a sudden, Emil Kraepelin, who was a psychiatrist, there's a shift then that occurs with him. And he was the first one who actually published real psychometric data on the influence of actually caffeine and alcohol in the 1890s on the brain. Okay? And he concluded through his studies that chronic alcohol use provoked brain lesions. Didn't have the imaging that we have today, but based on the evidence that he saw and his knowledge of neurology, okay, he was able to say, you know what, chronic alcohol use causes brain damage, which is true. Led to a permanent cognitive decline, and he even decided to stop drinking. He became a teetotaler because of this knowledge. So the disease model, and this was to develop the disease model. So this model, you have an organ, and if you use diabetes as an example, the pancreas, okay? You've got a pancreas that's impaired, and it's not, because of that, the body is not able to process sugar the way it ought. So there's an impairment in the pancreas. You've got specific cells that are called islet cells in the pancreas that are not doing their job. And so the glucose or the sugar in the bloodstream isn't doing what it's supposed to do or able to get to the other tissues the way it needs to. And because of that, it causes symptoms. It causes a number of symptoms. Okay, you get thirsty. You have to urinate all the time or you eat all the time. Those are some of the symptoms that are in diabetes. Okay, and that was a whole new model. So alcohol or alcoholism, as it was defined, started fitting that model. Jelinek is another guy who really published a lot of some of the seminal work on this, that alcoholism was a systematic progressive loss of control through phases that, if left untreated, resulted in death. So it was predictable. He described four stages of what would happen. It was predictable, it was chronic, and if untreated, could lead to an often dead lead to death, just like other chronic diseases could. In 1956, the American Medical Association defined alcoholism officially as a disease because it's progressive. That means it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. It's predictable, okay? You get 100 people who are drinking alcohol on a regular basis, and you're gonna see the same thing in those 100 people. It's primary, okay? It's not because of something else, but it's primarily because of the alcohol one is consuming. It's chronic, okay? Unlike an acute disease like a pneumonia, okay, this is something different. This is gonna continue. And again, it could be terminal, it can kill you. In 1972, the American Psychiatric Association also accepts the disease model of alcoholism. Addiction is a brain disease and it matters. Important publication in 1997 by Alan Leshner. It's a groundbreaking statement that highlighted decades of research on the brain, allowed for better treatment for people with addictions, created a debate of the tunnel vision aspect of this viewpoint, which is what we're also going to talk about, What about the psychological? What about the social? What about the cultural, the political aspects of addiction? Okay, so he was criticized, and rightly so, of saying it was only the brain, right? Or at least that's what people were taking from what he was saying. It's just a brain problem, right? And that's like saying syphilis, it was just a sin problem, right? It's just, you got more than just the brain here. So eventually he came around, updated his statement, say addiction isn't just a brain disease. And that's appropriate. So now the American Society of Addiction Medicine has, I think, a pretty good, a helpful definition of what addiction is. And they just refigured this definition in 2019. It's a treatable chronic medical disease involving complex interactions among brain circuits, genetics, the environment, and an individual's life experience. So they're capturing the whole of our humanity here, not just the organic, not just the brain. People with addiction use substances or engage in behavior that become compulsive and often continue despite harmful consequences. It's not an intellectual problem. Some of the smartest people that I've ever known in my life are people who have suffered from addiction. Prevention efforts and treatment approaches for addiction are generally as successful as those for other chronic diseases. That is a take-home point. That is a take-home point right there, is treatment does work. It takes a lot of time, it's a lot of hard work, and you gotta keep people engaged, and we'll talk about that. But one of the knocks that addiction treatment gets is, well, these people don't ever get better. Well, actually, when you look at this compared to other chronic diseases and the rates of relapse or recurrence of their symptoms, it's actually as good or even better in some cases than some of other chronic diseases. And so here you see relapse is common, 40 to 60%. Type 2 diabetes is 30 to 50%. Hypertension, 50 to 70%. Asthma, 50 to 70%. So these people with asthma, hypertension, diabetes, they're ending up in the hospital just as much, if not more so, for their relapses or recurrences of their symptoms of their disease than people with addiction are. Nature versus nurture. So we know, it's well established, that there are genetic predispositions that somebody has if they develop addiction. So if you have an addiction disorder, substance use disorder, it is pretty darn likely that you have a parent or a grandparent who also have a substance use disorder. So that's when I'm doing my history of folks and I'm screening, I'll ask, do you have any addiction in your family, for instance? It's very, very common to pass that on, just like it is for diabetes, just like it is for cardiac disease, okay? Also, there's genes that predict our liking and our craving that some will have and some won't. How many people here love the sun? Love the sun, not Jesus. Love the sun. I'm assuming you all love Jesus. But the sun and the sunlight. How many people love the sun so much that when it's a bright sunny day, you go outside, you open up the curtains, and you can look directly at the sun because it feels so good? How many of you are like that? Okay. And so you are what is described as the photophiles, okay? Because you love the sun. And how many of you, like me, I like the sun, but when I go out there, it's brightness, I need to put my sunglasses on, and it's disturbing, and it's hard on my eyes. How many are like that? Okay, that's like I am, okay? Now, they've determined that that's a genetic influence. So there's genetics that are able to differentiate who goes into which of those buckets. And it's you photophiles that I worry about the most. Because you are the ones then that are the risk takers, tend to be the risk takers. You're the ones who, just the normal stimulus doesn't really get you. Okay? So you're the ones who are going to be like, jumping off buildings and doing these sort of things to get that dopamine rush that most of us get just naturally. All right?
What if you like the rain?
Then you've got a whole different set of problems. We'll talk later. All right. So genetics influence the number of receptors that we are born with in our brain that these drugs are acting upon. That, like I said, the reward center and how that's shaped and formed.
a whole bunch of things, okay? And then, of course, genetics don't have to happen in a vacuum, but then we've also got our set of environment. Okay, the people that we were born to has a significant influence on how we behave, right? And we know that. So if you are born, let's use diabetes as an example. If you were born as part of a family that doesn't take a lot of stock in healthy diet or lifestyle, but have no bones, just eating junk food all the time and living a sedentary lifestyle, you are more likely to develop diabetes. It's just the way it is. Rocks are hard, water's wet. And if you grow up in a family where drug use is common or alcohol use is very, very common, and especially over the last 20 years, now most kids in Appalachia are growing up with their families or their peers who drug use has been really common, you're more likely going to be using drugs and you're more likely then to develop addiction. So there's both the genetics and there's also the environment that one is raised in. Also, this is fascinating. Something we're learning more and more about is epigenetics. So we are born with a certain set of genetics. However, our environment turns these genes off and on. This is fascinating work that still blows me out of the water. So they've done like rodent studies, for instance. And I'll use marijuana as an example. Marijuana is, they've been able to determine that for instance, a male rat who is exposed, and these scientists have fun, giving marijuana cigarettes to rats and getting them exposed, then it changes the genetics of the sperm of that rat to the point that it's affecting their grandchildren in ways that's changed. And it makes their grandchildren more likely to choose other drugs, for example, if they're exposed to cannabis, marijuana, as a male rat. Yeah, it's amazing. All right, so let's talk. We're going to stop here. Gosh, I never get through everything I want to get through. So I think we need to stop now for a break.
You can go for 5 more minutes if you want.
All right, I'm going to talk about the brain for 5 more minutes, okay? Because I think we need to. So when you think about the brain and what I'm going to be talking to you about, I want you to think about tracks. And an analogy is, for instance, these great migratory tracks here of animals, throughout history, thousands upon thousands of years. You've got these herds of caribou, for instance, or Cindy and I just went to Nebraska, and we saw the greatest migration every year of sandhill cranes that are coming through Nebraska. And so that was a great time, but it's predictable. But these tracks that you could see of all of these creatures that through thousands of years and passed on to generation to generation has been made because of the high activity over and over and over again. These are the common tracks that are being used across the country. In our brains, when we are engaging in activities we use over and over again, it changes the brain to create tracks that make it so much more easy to follow a behavior because of what's happened in the brain. With me?
Yep.
Okay. Neurons that fire together, wire together is one of the pearls of neurology. So the more you are using those particular neurons, the stronger they get, the wider they get, the bigger they get, and they're being used. Okay, so the brain. I'm going to give you a little neurology tutorial. And I'm going to break the brain down for you. Entirely, like, really, really complex. You ready for this? I'm going to break it down into three main parts. Ready? The back part, the middle part, and the front part. All right? Back part, the middle part, and the front part. The back part of the brain. This part of the brain here, and so this is the brain, okay? Seven. Back part of the brain, okay, is the most primitive part of the brain. This is the part of the brain that's responsible for things we don't even think about. Coordination. We're walking, we're not thinking about walking, most of us. Brain stem, okay? Heart rate, breathing, these sort of things. Blinking, not thinking about this stuff. All of the stuff that's back here. This is the area that is very common to other creatures on our planet that have brains. Okay, a lot of them share this stuff. the further you go this way, the more sophisticated and more human the brain becomes. The middle part of the brain is the area of the brain that's responsible for storing memories. It's the area of the brain that's responsible for emotions, okay? And it's also the area of the brain that's got my favorite point of the brain, which is what's called the nucleus accumbens. And it's the nucleus accumbens that releases dopamine. Who knows what dopamine is? Go ahead.
It's the pleasure drug.
Yes. John really likes dopamine. It's the pleasure drug. And don't we all? Okay, so this is the stuff that whenever we're feeling or doing anything that's enjoyable, dopamine is released, okay? God made it that way. Okay? God made that way. So whenever we are engaged in pleasurable activities, a good meal, sex, exercise, hugging your grandmother, dopamine is released. And God made it such that when dopamine released, that feels good. And when we feel good, we want to keep doing it. And so we want to continue to do good behaviors, behaviors that are good for us, right?
All of the same.
The problem is when that area, and this is where the whole pleasure center is centered. And the problem is when you are using a substance, a drug, or even gambling over long enough periods of time, what happens is, if you use cocaine, for instance, cocaine has a like turbo boost of dopamine that happens when you have cocaine. And then the body said, whoa, this feels really good, and I want to keep doing it. You keep doing it over and over and over again, okay, the brain starts, and I'll talk about the higher rate, but the brain starts rewiring such that that's where you start going to, even to the detriment of everything else in your life that has natural rewards. You see this, for instance, in studies with rats where they put these, now you got these masochistic scientists who put these poor little rats in a cage, and they have an option of hitting a cocaine lever with their little rat paw, or hitting a lever for a food bolus. Okay, and you get these poor little cocaine-addicted rats in these cages, and then the scientists watch what they do. That poor little cocaine-addicted rat will sit there and hit that cocaine level until it starves to death and dies. All right. So what we see is that little rat brain has been rewired such that it wants cocaine more than it wants the food it needs to survive. So that's the middle part of the brain. The front part of the brain is the part of the brain that makes us most human. This is where we, especially this area here called the prefrontal cortex, we have more neurons here in the prefrontal cortex exponentially than any other creature on Earth. And this is the area that really helps us make good decisions. This is the what's called the executive decision part of the brain. And so this is the area that lets us look forward and anticipate the consequences of the decisions we're making right now. It's the area that puts the brake on everything else. And so this is the area that's usually dislodged when we're in the middle of a road rage, for instance. But this is the area then that is really more of the CEO suite of our brains, okay? And this helps damper this. The more and more you use, the more and more, especially from a young age, those tracks get cut off from that part of the brain. So I mentioned the rat, and so that's a rat. Let me mention one of the stories of one of my patients that continues to stick with me when I was young in my career in my inpatient unit. I was treating a nurse, and this nurse is a male nurse. No, I'm sorry, I'm thinking different. This is a female nurse who kept coming in at different times for severe alcohol problems. And to the point where the courts got involved, and she had a seven-year-old son, and this got to the point where the judge said, you need to make this stick. You need to make treatment stick and stop drinking because you are an unfit mother and unsafe to take care of yourself. Single mom. And what is the strongest human bond that you can think of?
Mother and child.
It's between a mother and a child, okay? It's hard to think of a stronger bond, a stronger natural bond between a mother and a child. And what happened was this person, this lovely lady who I treated, who loved her, I knew that she loved her son. I know for a fact that she loved her son. time came to go before the judge and prove that she was fit enough to become a to get her son back. And what happens that day when she goes before the judge? She was intoxicated. Okay? And that really hit home to me early on. There are powerful, powerful forces that work in this person's brain. That are keep, because I know, right? I know that she desperately wanted to be a good mother, but something was going on that really impaired her ability to do that. Right? So you can think of rats, but when we think of the human life where this is occurring, this is reality. And so let's go ahead and we'll stop here. And can we come back in 5 minutes? Is that okay with everybody? 5 minutes, enough for a break? Okay, thanks.